Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up today. First, in a little while, we'll talk with Eric Garris, who is the founder of antiwar.com. We'll talk to him about the state of the anti-war movement, and he comes at it from not your typical position. He's a libertarian who did have a past in radical left politics, but became a follower of Murray Rothbard and limited government and all that, but he is very much the anti-imperialist. We'll talk to him about his point of view, and also a lot of the more leftish anti-war groups are missing in action now that Afghanistan is Obama's war. We can talk to him about that as well. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear an interview recorded earlier in the week with the novelist Gary Steingart, author of the new book, Super Sad True Love Story, really excellent novel. Dystopic novel, but not very far from reality, I'm afraid to say, about a broke and repressed United States. Okay. Before all that, as I was coming over here, I realized I forgot to prepare anything about Larry Summers, who is leaving as the head of the National Economic Council, and I don't have very much to say, but everyone who talks about Summers says he's a very smart fellow, although he left Harvard, of which he was president before coming to work in the administration. He left Harvard deep in debt. He urged him to borrow lots of money and speculate in the markets, and the bets turned out to be not so good, and now Harvard has been borrowing to pay its operating expenses. But I guess Larry Summers is very, very smart. He did help design the stimulus package, which, for all its many faults, not being big enough and not being devoted enough towards long-term infrastructure, was certainly better than nothing and about the best thing the Obama administration has done in its year and, 9 months in office. He is likely to be replaced with someone worse, I'm afraid. There's a lot of pressure coming on Obama to replace him with somebody coming from the world of business. I don't really understand why people think that experience in business somehow translates into politics or policy, totally different worlds, and I'm not even convinced that American business has been running itself all that impressively, but that is the orthodoxy, and also the orthodoxy is that Obama has been hostile to business, which is very hard to believe. He certainly has given them loose regulations and a big bailout. But nonetheless, he's perceived as somehow kind of some kind of Kenyan anti-colonial socialist or something like that on the right. Well, I guess he's got to make peace with the business establishment. He did say some months back that he called Wall Street people fat cats, and they've never recovered from this grievous insult. So I guess these are a bunch of thin-skinned people who have to be flattered. A friend of mine said years ago that the American rich no longer want to pay taxes, they want to be paid tribute, and I think she was really onto something. Okay, the U.S. economy continues its noble attempt to find its feet with mixed success. In the no-kidding department, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, a panel of eight economists who are the official arbiters of recession and recovery in the U.S. economy, they declared on September 20th that the Great Recession ended in June, not June 2010, but June 2009. That may surprise a civilian audience in at least two ways. First, what took them so long? The answer is that they really, really want to be sure, and a 15-month delay is actually about average for the last 30 years. And second, the news that the recession is over may strike some people as strange, or at least premature. There are over 300,000 fewer jobs last month than when the recession officially ended in June 2009. The unemployment rate is a tenth of a point higher, and would be a lot higher if a lot of people hadn't dropped out of the labor force. The share of the adult population with a job is off by almost a full percentage point in the 15 months since the recession ended. But, you know, GDP. Real GDP, that is, the total value of goods and services produced in the U.S. adjusted for inflation, stopped shrinking in the middle of last year and is up a miserable 1.7% since then. Not an average growth rate, but a total of 1.7%. And since, to a bourgeois economist, the economy is about money and not people, the recession is over. Doesn't that make you feel better? Speaking of miserable, the housing market, which led us into this mess, isn't showing much leadership in getting us out. July's housing figures are uniformly awful. August's, which we're just now starting to get, are coming in a little better. As Economy.com's Dismal Scientist Service put it on Thursday morning, August sales of existing homes recovered somewhat from the July freefall, but this gain only brings the pace of sales up to the high end of miserable. But applications for new mortgages have been down for the last several weeks, and the Federal Housing Finance Agency's price index, released the other day, was off by 0.5% in the month. That's a July number, though, so maybe that's just a relic of that really bad month. But first-time applications for unemployment insurance filed by people who just lost their jobs rose 12,000 last week following 2 weeks of decline. Right now, this number seems essentially trendless, up 1 week and down the next, but stuck at a high level. The job market is off life support, but it's not bounding out of bed ready to run a half marathon either. And the Federal Open Market Committee, the group within the Federal Reserve that sets monetary policy, met earlier in the week and decided to keep the spigots wide open. They're still concerned that the recovery is weak. Further, their statement expressed discreet worry that the economy was in danger of sinking into deflation, a period of falling prices and shrinking activity that almost no one but the most extreme sadomonetarist would enjoy. Okay, enough business cycle news. On to something of longer-term interest. We'll hear later in the show from Gary Steingart, whose excellent dystopian novel, Super Sad True Love Story, depicts an American future of corporatized, wired illiteracy. By one of those freakish bits of coincidence that would seem unbelievable in fiction, I just read the New York Times, which I still get delivered every morning in its dead tree format, that Mark Zuckerberg, one of the founders of Facebook, of which I am, I must disclose, an avid user, is planning to give $100 million to the public schools of Newark, New Jersey. Parenthetically, I'm not sure how Zuckerberg can actually put his hands on $100 million. He's supposedly worth, in a monetary sense, something like $2 billion. Facebook is wildly successful, of course. Something like one in every 12 Earthlings has an account, no exaggeration. But the valuation of Facebook is mostly on paper. It's not making oodles of money right now, and I don't get how Zuckerberg is a centimillionaire in any money more tangible than that of the mind. But hey, in the world of Web 2.0, or is it 3.0? No. Oh, now I keep losing count. You got a dream. Let's leave all that aside. So Zuckerberg, who grew up in Westchester, now lives in California, and has absolutely nothing to do with Newark, wants to give $100 million to the schools in a desperately poor city whose schools could use every penny they can get their hands on. The city's school system has spent 15 years in a kind of receivership under state and not local control. So Zuckerberg has now made a deal with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to turn some control of the schools back to the city and its mayor, Cory Booker. Christie is a budget-cutting Republican and Booker a sleek corporate New Democrat, but both are in love with what is euphemized as education reform, which means privatization, competition, charter schools, and lots of testing. Curiously, corporate America also loves this agenda, and so does the Obama administration. And where will these three men, Christie, Booker, and Zuckerberg, make the official announcement? On the Oprah Winfrey Show. As I say at the beginning of the interview with Steingart, this country is almost impossible to satirize since it does so much of the satirical work on its own. Of course, it's important to point out that the so-called school reform agenda doesn't work. Some charter schools are quite good and some are quite awful, but the evidence is that, on balance, they have little effect on educational outcomes. The problems of a school system like Newark's are that the city is full of poor people leading very hard lives. Even a $100 million gift won't change any of that. Neither will Web 9.0, or whenever and wherever that might be. So why does corporate America love charter schools so much? Partly it's ideological. The rhetoric of choice and competition appeals to their businessy minds. But charters are also a way to break teachers' union and cut salaries. So even if charters and the rest of the debased agenda, like frequent testing, make no educational sense, they can give us the same depressing outcome at half the price. The school reform movement took some serious hits in last week's elections. In New York, the three candidates most prominently associated with it, who were showered with cash from Wall Street, all lost badly. And Washington's current mayor, Adrian Fenty, also lost to a primary challenger. There are other local issues at stake, notably the perception of the city's black voters that Fenty, a Booker and Obama-style New Democrat, wasn't doing much for them. But his aggressive school reform agenda was an important part of the mix. His school's chief, Michelle Rhee, is reportedly a favorite to run New Jersey schools now that she'll be out of a job when Fenty leaves office. When corporate America loves something, it doesn't matter that it lacks any empirical or popular support. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk about anti-war. And that was some of the Sonata in B-flat major, Control 333 by Mozart, third movement, performed by Alfred Brendel. And I got an email a week or two ago informing me that I was mispronouncing Alfred Brendel's name. It's not Brendel, it's Brendel. He's Viennese, damn it, as the correspondent informed me. And I guess so. Now I'll say Brendel. So maybe I should also start saying Österreich instead of Austria, if we're going to be consistent. Okay, we're now joined by Eric Garris, who is the founder of antiwar.com, a prominent location on the web for anti-war activism, anti-imperial activism. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I was reading up on your personal political history earlier and discovered that you have had a communist mother, I believe, and spent some time on the left in your youth, and then kind of fell for Murray Rothbard. Tell us your political biography, autobiography.
Oh, well, yes, that's true. I grew up on the left. My mother was an active leftist, and I used to be in the Peace and Freedom Party in California. As I developed politically, I started realizing that big government and war and the denial of people's civil liberties were all tied together, and that you can't have there's a connection between personal liberty, economic liberty, and peace.
Antiwar.com is a project of the Randolph Bourne Institute, is that right?
Correct. The Randolph Bourne Institute's main project is running antiwar.com.
Tell us a bit about Bourne.
Well, Randolph Bourne was an anti-war activist before and during World War I, and he was an outspoken writer. He was also something of an anarchist.
And most famous for a wonderful essay about war as the health of the state, right?
That's right, war as the health of the state, which is really the essence of the belief of the people that founded antiwar.com.
So now tell us about antiwar.com. What's the history of that?
Well, we've been around for 15 years now. We originally started during the wars in the Balkans. We were opposing President Clinton's aggression in Bosnia and Kosovo. And during the Kosovo War is when we really started getting a lot of traffic and going to become a full-time website. And since then, we have grown, and we now have, on average, between 60 and 100,000 regular visitors every day. We get millions of page views a month, and we are updated 7 days a week, every day of the year, around the clock.
And are you a total pacifist or just opposed to most wars that have come down the pike?
Well, no, I personally am not a pacifist. We do have pacifists that work with us. Our news editor, Jason Ditz, is a pacifist. But we have people from all over the political spectrum who agree on the issue that we need to oppose U.S. wars and U.S. imperialism. And there's a lot of people that support that position for many different reasons, on the right, on the left, and across the spectrum.
Now, I think some of this might surprise at least some people in the audience who, when they think of the right, think of neoconservatives, Dick Cheney, George Bush, John Bolton, you know, enthusiastic oppressors and warriors. That is not really the whole story of the American right, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, the pre-World War II days of the American right was pretty much anti-war. And they saw the tie-in between big government and empire. As a matter of fact, some of the early real fighting against empire was during the Spanish-American War and pre-World War I, when we were occupying the Philippines, occupying Cuba, and many of the leaders of the anti-war movement, of the Anti-Imperialist League at that time, were Republicans.
And I had on the show a couple of times Richard Seymour, who has written from the Marxist left on the close relation between liberalism and imperialism throughout the centuries. So you certainly have at least some support coming from the far left, criticizing kind of mainstream liberalism.
Well, yes. A lot of the people who consider themselves big government liberals are in favor of big government, not just domestically, but in terms of forcing our view of government around the world, a lot of these people believe that we need to enforce our views. This led to us trying to create war for democracy during the Vietnam War and going and fighting against supposed dictators like Saddam Hussein. That we didn't support Saddam, but the U.S. intervention has only made things worse in Iraq, and that's the problem. U.S. intervention makes things worse for the countries that we invade, and it also makes things worse for the American people. The kind of problems that we have now in the economy are due in large part to the incredible spending that's been going on for the wars in the last 10 years.
Well, of course, you know, Republicans, mainstream Republicans, even you know, the right, more right wing of the party, with some exceptions, have no problem with military spending. They rail up against big government, but they have no problem if you're writing checks to the Pentagon, right?
Well, that's one of the problems with, on the right too, is that people have their own view of what they want to have the government enforce, and unfortunately, a lot of the people on the right say we have to cut spending, we have to cut taxes, but not in terms of quote national defense. But this is starting to turn in another direction, especially since Obama has come into office. You've seen more and more conservative Republicans turning against the Afghanistan war and saying that the Iraq war was wrong.
I want to return to this theme in a moment, but there was a way in which the Kosovo War, which is what got you to found antiwar.com, kind of greased the way or lubricated the path of the invasion of Iraq. Wasn't there this whole notion of humanitarian intervention made imperial war more acceptable to at least part of the left end of the spectrum, didn't it?
That's correct, although it's really nothing new. The humanitarian aspects of occupation and war have always been touted in order to garner support at home.
I'm speaking with Eric Garris, who is the founder of antiwar.com and a longtime anti-imperial, anti-war activist. There was an anti-war movement, very vigorous, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq a few days after that war began, but it began to taper off. And now we see that there's very little opposition to the war in Afghanistan, it seems, that at least public opposition, organized opposition. And there's some sense in which once it became Obama's war, and he's escalated it, carrying into Pakistan, doing more drone assassinations than his predecessor did, killing people instead of jailing him in Gitmo, seems to be his way of solving that problem. A lot of the leftish end of the anti-war movement has gone silent, it seems to me. I mean, the United for Peace and Justice, which, you know, has sadly some ties to the old Communist Party and ties to the Democratic Party, has been pretty quiet. Am I reading things correctly? Has this portion of the anti-war movement gone largely silent?
Unfortunately, you're correct. And I think one of the main reasons is that people on the left are still hopeful about Obama, and they don't want to criticize him on the war because they're more focused on domestic issues. And they're hopeful that Obama is going to see the light and start pulling troops out. But the fact is that if you look at his plans and his actions, it's quite the opposite. It came out this morning as the Woodward book is leaked out before its publication, that U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan killed American citizens.
Well, Obama has authorized the assassination of American citizens as well, which is something that Bush didn't do.
Well, Bush broke the law and did those sorts of things. What Obama is doing is he's taking the areas where Bush broke the law and making them the law. So these are things that are no longer going to be illegal. They're going to be policy.
So this is the liberal respect for the rule of law, I guess.
That's right.
Give us the measure of what's going on in Afghanistan now. I think a lot of people have just not been paying attention, but how many troops are there and how deadly is the conflict now?
Well, there's over 100,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and things are not going well. American intervention abroad tends not to accomplish what it sets out to do. And what you have now is the exploration of mission creep. You have different people who are favoring the war for different reasons, and you almost have a pro-war coalition. Some people who want to look out for the rights of women, other people who say we have to fight Al-Qaeda and work with the Taliban, other people that say that we have to destroy the Taliban. But what we're doing is we're creating more and more opposition. The more troops we send, the more military activity, the more the Taliban and Al-Qaeda grow in that part of the world.
And how much is this war costing us, do we know?
Well, the expenditures are hard to figure, but basically when you count everything, when you count the cost of the troops there, you count the cost of the foreign aid, you count the cost of the stolen money that the Afghani corruption is costing, and then you count the future costs of interest on the debt, because we're not paying for this in taxes, we're paying for it by printing more money. When you count all of those things in, the future cost of caring for veterans and that sort of thing, we're talking about $1 trillion a year.
And that's on top of what Iraq has cost and is continuing to cost us.
That's correct. And there's no indication that this number is going to go down. In fact, it's likely to go up.
And what exactly is the situation in Iraq now? And the administration wants us to believe that the combat role has ended, although they're not doing a mission accomplished moment. But what exactly is the extent of our involvement there now?
Well, that's just a reclassification. In fact, all the troops there are still considered combat troops in that they get combat pay. They're still getting shot. They're still dying. And the slight reduction that we've seen in troops in Iraq has been more than taken up by the additional contractors that we're sending there. We now have slightly less than 100,000 troops in Iraq and the surrounding areas. A lot of them have been moved into Kuwait, and we have about 55,000 in Iraq. But now there's about 150,000 contractors who have taken the place of the troops who have left. So we really have not decreased our footprint there.
And they're more expensive and less accountable than actual GIs.
That's true. That's true. It is more expensive. But then again, they can do a lot of things that we won't even hear about.
So we've only got about 4 minutes to go. So let's say, what about agitation against these horrendous wars? Now, what is the state of the anti-war movement?
Well, the thing that's going to revive the anti-war movement is if they start moving toward a single issue opposition, so that we can bring the mainstream, we can bring the right and the left united to stop the war. The people have to get over their differences. We need to reach out to the Liberal Democrats. We need to reach out to the Tea Party, who opposes big government, and explain to them that this includes opposition to American imperialism.
Where do the Tea Party, and it's a very broad group of people, but where in general do the Tea Partiers stand on war?
Well, they're all over the map. There have been some, there was a big Tea Party rally in San Francisco a few weeks ago, 1,000 people, and it was essentially an anti-war, anti-tax rally. So there is a real, these people are open to these ideas, but they need to be sold in a way that is comfortable to them. So we need to bring these groups together in a non-hostile manner to work to fight against the war. That's the most important thing.
Now, we have a bunch of people who disagree rather vehemently on issues of social policy or economic policy. I'm sure you and I wouldn't have much common ground in economic policy, but we are both quite opposed to the wars. Is it possible for us to work together and overlook those other differences?
Well, we have to if we're going to stop the wars. One of the things that we're working on in the long term is a project called Come Home America, because we can all agree, you and I can agree, that we need to bring the troops home and we need to stop spending this money. And then we can decide, what are we going to spend the money, the savings on? But first, we have to stop the runaway spending that is bankrupting the American economy.
And, of course, the Pentagon is a very, very large portion of that runaway spending.
It's the most significant portion.
But
it's certainly the one that can be tackled the easiest.
So what about practicalities? Are there events scheduled, rallies, meetings? How can left meet right on the anti-war agenda?
Well, as I said, this Come Home America, that's something which we expect to get started by early next year. People can go to antiwar.com, and we're going to have more and more information about that coming up. And also, you should go to antiwar.com just to see what's really going on. We present this full spectrum of opposition to the war, and we do it every day of the year.
All right, well, thank you. I've got to bring it to an end there, but thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Eric Garris, who is a founder of antiwar.com, and I urge everyone to do as he says, check it out and see if we can get a kind of cross-the-spectrum opposition to these two wars going, because without that, they'll just go on and bankrupt us and kill lots of people. Okay, let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back to talk with Gary Steingart.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, please do hit the donate button. We could always use your help. And check out the BAI Buddy thing, and if you like Behind the News, become Behind the News' buddy. Why not? All right, music, and then Gary Steingart. Was some of Daft Punk's Digital Love from 2001. I thought a good setup for this interview recorded early in the week with Gary Steingart, who is the author of the dystopian novel Super Sad True Love Story, just out from Random House. And the book is a story of a repressive, polarized, illiterate, and broke USA, which is not very far from reality in a lot of ways. But despite that depressing subject, it is stylistically brilliant, funny, and inventive, and just admirably wonderful in many ways. His previous novel, Absurdistan, was featured a 325-pound guy with a botched circumcision. This one doesn't, so as he said in an interview with the Financial Times, this one's for the ladies. I recorded this in his new noisy apartment, which is near Beth Israel Hospital in Manhattan, and I tried to get some of the noises out with a filter, but some of them survived. I apologize, but he's a very busy man. This is the only place I could get to talk to him. Okay, Gary Steingart. I was thinking the other day when I heard that an environmentally themed high school in L.A. was built in the site of, named after Al Gore, was built in the site of a toxic waste dump, that this country almost resists satire, or satirizes itself. How do you conceptualize satire in a place that seems so utterly satire-proof?
Well, I think I started out satirizing the former Soviet Union, which also is very satire-proof. And the first two books, especially the second book, Absurdistan, was spent with my sort of rampaging around the former Soviet Union and picking up hysterical bits here and there, and in this fundamentally corrupt society, falling ever lower. And then I realized I don't have to leave the country. I can just stay home and have a good time here. You know, things have changed so much in the last decade that this country all of a sudden is as ripe for satire as it's ever been.
Yeah, you know, we don't have our Mencken. You know, we could use a Mencken these days, but there isn't one around.
There's no Mencken, yeah. It's just funny. Well, maybe Jon Stewart is Mencken-ish in some ways. But
different medium. Now, of course, you left the Soviet Union when you were pretty young. But are there ways in which the present-day United States reminds you of a Soviet Union and its sort of Brezhnev stagnation leading to its transformation?
I think one thing that happens when empires, countries begin to totter is there's an exaggerated sense of patriotism. The flags get bigger, and every time I drive in the highways, I notice some real doozies of a flag out there. Xenophobia begins to rear itself. Witness what's happening in Arizona. So I think that when a society becomes unsure of its own future, it manifests itself through constantly defending its supposed way of life. And America's always had a very decent way of life and has always placed well in terms of rankings of countries. But these days, it seems to be slipping away, and especially with so much of what of the good jobs being outsourced and being replaced by other countries. And the main thing that worries me and is sort of a phantom concern of the book is the collapse of the kind of education and the primary level that we've always taken for granted. There's just nobody wants to invest in education, it seems like.
And all our great universities become subsidiaries of Chinese institutions?
Somebody just sent me, a friend of mine just sent me a link to a Singaporean university that's hooking up with, I can't remember which one.
Yale is doing a partnership. But they won't give Yale degrees. They'll be, Yale proudly points out that NYU Abu Dhabi gets NYU degrees, but Yale Singapore will give Singapore degrees.
Just give it a couple of decades and we'll see what kind of degree will be.
With the endowment down 25%.
Right, exactly.
Judith Butler said once that when you do parody, you sort of have to inhabit the role you're parodying. I don't know if that applies exactly to satire, but is there some sense in which you find this totally electronified world seductive or appealing?
Well, I did begin to delve into that world very seriously for this book. I had a research assistant who set me up with Facebook and the iPhone and all this stuff. And are there seductive things about it? Very much so, because it's a kind of, what it does is it creates this sense that you're constantly submitting things, thoughts, photos, whatever it is, and looking for approval from a vast group of people, you know, that big thumbs up you get on Facebook. It's very interesting because it's a kind of instant gratification. You don't have to spend 3 or 4 years working on a project. You take a funny wiener dog picture, up it goes, you know. And people say, that's a very nice wiener dog picture you just put up there. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it sort of slices and dices my attention span. And this book was written, super sad true love story kind of dives from one thing to another, from diary entries to emails. So I think as I was writing it and as my mind was being filleted by electronic medium, it sort of began to resemble some of the stuff that began to worry me.
I guess it's the postmodern equivalent of an epistolary novel.
It is an epistolary novel. In fact, if anything, it's a little too literary. You know, Eunice, one of the characters who's very young and very post-digital, who spends most of her time in the novel shopping online, she writes very long emails, which I think are really also falling out of favor as we continue among a certain group of people.
Yeah, when email first got popular, there's a certain kind of technological optimist who thought this meant the return of correspondence, the return of prose in a TV-corrupted culture, but no longer?
Well, in the beginning, I remember sending very long emails as I was shifting from written communication to emails, but I'm writing a collection of essays, and I was looking at some of the letters that my ex-girlfriend in college and I sent to each other. And I was shocked. I mean, some of them were 13, 15 pages long, filled with all kinds of, you know, little digressions that turn into mini stories, not just on my part, on her part as well. And she's not a writer by trade, you know. We're just in love with language, in love with expressing ourselves, and in love with the idea of letting our imaginations roam. I worry sometimes that, you know, a lot of things that are on the internet are supposed to be calculated to be wacky and show both the intelligence and the avant-gardeness of the people who are posting these things. And yet at the same time, it seems to me like these calculated public things are actually when you take them, when you sort of average them out, they're pretty close to the median. They're not that exciting, you know. They're not that subversive, I should say, because people, you know, I think the internet has a kind of conforming effect. A lot of people, when we're on it, we, you know, you want to put your best face forward, or you want to put forward the face that you think people will like and respond favorably to. When you write a novel, I think sometimes when I read literature, contemporary literature, it feels like that's where all the subversive stuff ends up, the stuff that you don't put on the internet. Some of it is fascinating, you know. Novels by Sam Lipsyte, for example, have this incredibly wonderful caustic edge that you don't find anywhere, at least that I don't find with such beauty on the internet.
Yeah, well, Bourdieu said of TV that it thrives in a kind of sensationalism that seems exciting but really can't cause you to stop and think. It can't interrupt the flow. The time has to move on quickly. Is the internet kind of a hyped up version of that?
Yeah, I think so. And speaking of TV, what I actually find interesting is I do find subversive shows like The Wire, The Sopranos, to some extent even Mad Men, because they do challenge how I think of narrative. In some ways, these are sort of giant novels that have been stretched out into 60, 80-hour television, I would say almost novelizations, because so many of the writers, the great writers like Richard Price, who writes for The Wire, George Pelicanos, they now work in that medium as well. So I'm fascinated by what TV, in a weird way, TV ended up, in this decade anyway, as a kind of winner to this kind of narrative sweepstakes.
I was cheered when I saw a young woman on the L train coming over here reading a book on her iPad. So, but I noticed that you constantly poke fun at Lenny the characters poke fun at him for reading books.
Yeah, these shelves that you see, they haven't been assembled yet, but these shelves will contain the wall of books that Lenny has. As you can see, my TV isn't that large, and once a cable repairman came and said, "Oh man, why you got all them books and such a small TV?" He couldn't believe that it was going on. It seemed like a real misplace of values on my part. So on this book tour, some people have been giving me e-books and Kindles to sign. I do it, you know.
How do you sign a Kindle?
They'll have either a special pen so I can write on the back, or they'll have a piece of paper on the iPad especially. They'll have a piece of paper plastered over the back, and they'll have their favorite author sign the back.
But I think it's the fat guy in the waiting lounge who says the book smells like wet socks.
Yeah.
But then he gets his. Right?
It wasn't the fat guy. No, it was another guy. It's a credit ape from Lando Lakes Credit. God, it's impossible to explain this thing to an audience.
They'll just have to buy the book.
Please, yeah. That's hopefully what they'll have to do. Book smell. It's funny. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of the country, not so much in New York, but I take out a book and I feel so self-conscious. You know, people walk past me as if I'm some kind of weirdo. You know, books have been relegated to the very margins, I think, of our culture.
But if you look at the numbers, book sales down just a few percent, a million titles a year being published now, so something's getting out there.
Something's getting out there. No, I'm very happy that several literary titles like my own have done reasonably well in the last year. That feels very nice. But, you know, I think the average age is about 42 of readership, and I think about 40% of Americans bought a book last year. Maybe that's okay. You know, look, obviously we're not
doing better than newspapers.
Yes. At Columbia, I teach at the School of the Arts, and my window faces the School of Journalism, and I think their position is much more worrisome than our own.
The sirens remind me that I read in an interview with you that you were obsessed with death from a very early age.
Yeah.
And the character works for a life extension firm or life immortalization firm. Is this how you worked out your anxiety about death?
You know, actually, after I finished writing this book, I did feel a little bit better about dying. I don't feel great about it, but I felt like all my fears were so exposed on the page that at least I don't have to turn these thoughts over in my mind all the time. They've been kind of settled. I'm going to die. You know, it's not going to be great, but that's I was very sick from an early age, as I think many writers are. You know, I had a terrible asthma. I grew up in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, Russia, which is built on a swamp essentially, and so not a good place for somebody who has asthma. And I remember the ambulance is much like the one we just heard coming for me all the time and taking me to the hospital because they didn't have inhalers. So it was all kinds of weird medicines to try to clear out the stopping up my lungs. Strange.
returning to the theme of the impossible is satirized in this society, I was noticed on CNN this morning that on the news crawl that 9 kids in California died of whooping cough. And the next item was that a special area had been reserved in, I think, Dodger Stadium for people with peanut allergies. It was going to be a peanut-free zone. Now, there's this, it seems to capture this kind of polarization between an extreme concern with health and yet a vast sickness that represents social decay.
Well, I wonder if the two aren't in some ways related. I mean, if you're witnessing the death of something like the society that America once was, you begin to somehow subconsciously equate it with your own mortality, and you want to live longer. You know, in the book, the only very high net worth individuals can strive for immortality. The rest of society dies much faster. The book looks at a kind of Brazilianization of society, where there's a very small elite group. I think in Brazil they're called the 500 families or something like that. Maybe the number's larger, 1,000 families that control very much of the country, and then the rest. Which is interesting, because when I emigrated from Russia, I think the idea was that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia would become more and more like America, and in the end, I think America is becoming more and more like Russia, a country without a real safety net, a country where the middle class has been eviscerated.
Actually, during the Soviet reform days, during the Gorbachev days, I had dinner with a Soviet economist who I said, you know, you think you're going to become United States, you could end up as Brazil. And he kind of misunderstood me, and he said, Brazil, he admired Brazil.
Yes.
So that was kind of a model for them.
Oh, no question. Yeah, there's that saying about Brazil. Brazil is the country of the future and always will be, which I think applies to Russia as well.
I'm speaking with Gary Steingart, author of the novel Super Sad True Love Story, just out from Random House. The dystopia that you come up with, it seems like a mix of the worst of the Bush era, all the security paranoia, and then the current financial crisis era. I mean, did you conceive this, begin writing this book during the days of Homeland Security?
Yes, although, you know, things have changed for the better, but I think there's still that incredible sense of paranoia, and I mean, Guantanamo hasn't been cleared out exactly, so I don't think there's been a... our perceptions of...
And Obama authorized the assassination of an American citizen, which is something that Bush didn't do.
Right. So, you know, in a sense, this happens a lot whenever a Democratic president takes over, the need to prove oneself to be, you know, tough on security or any kind of official. This is a right-wing country. I mean, I think this is what I've begun to understand. We may have elected our first African-American president, but this is essentially a right-wing country in the way that say, Canada is a center-left country. We are a right-wing country. So when I'm writing about the bipartisan party, I think that applies no matter where, you know, who's in office, which is the ruling party in my book, the bipartisan party.
Not far from reality.
Not far from reality, I think. As for, what was the other part of it? The economy. Well, when I started writing it, you know, in 2006, I started with the idea that the banks would collapse, and then, you know, GM and Ford would get bought out by Lando Lakes Margarine and become mostly a butter company, with very few cars. And as things began to sort of transpire in this direction, I started to make the novel worse and worse, until the whole country's bought by a Norwegian hedge fund. And I think that's sort of the problem with writing satire today, or writing anything today, is it's very hard to write about the present because it doesn't really exist. We're living in a world that's sort of set to fast forward, that's set to future mode all the time. So it's a moving target, you know, and that's why, and I think that's maybe why 24/7 cable channels, blogs, etc., they function, because in a sense people need, you know, you can't pick up a newspaper because that's already 24 hours old.
But on the other hand, I mean, these are processes that have been in place for a long time. We've been heading this way for a long time. You know, this has got a real history, and Americans don't think of that. So in some sense, that 24/7 always-on sensibility is a symptom of a pathology that really can't reflect in its own situation.
Yeah, no, I think America's always been the country of the future, which will be interesting, because as much as we think we're wired, et cetera, it only takes a trip to, say, Korea to realize that we're actually quite behind in those things. There are countries that are so much more wired than ours and so much more addicted to constant updates and to the digitalization of their lives and the kind of dehumanization of their lives. We're giving technology a kind of carte blanche to do with us whatever we want. We think we're programming it, but you know, after a certain point, it's the one that's programming us.
And of course, then we end up as deeply in hawk to the Chinese Central Bank, which of course we are already. But the head of the Chinese Central Bank is a visiting dignitary treated with great respect.
I think the head of the People's Bank of China is already a mighty leader, and it'll be only more so. You got to only follow the cash to figure out who's in charge, in a way.
Well, we have Tim Geithner talking tough to him now.
Oh, well, that's going to solve everything.
You wrote a novel. You seem like a man of books. Do you feel like a creature out of your time, or is it hopeless, or do you think that you can intervene in some kind of constructive way?
When I went to Oberlin, their slogan was, I think one person can change the world, so do we. But I never subscribed to that idea. I don't think one person can change the world. I mean, there was much hope that Obama would change the world, and especially in the way America relates to other countries, there's been a lot of positive stuff, obviously, but no one person can't really change the world. I can't change the world, that's for certain. And I don't really have a giant sort of moralizing mission. I see myself in some ways really as a journalist. Absurdistan required me to go to these countries, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and to take a lot of notes. A lot of what happened in that book seems satirical. Prostitutes running around Hyatt in Baku chanting Galliburton, Galliburton, because they wanted to sleep with Halliburton executives. But all this stuff really happened, And in terms of this book, it's set in the future. It's dystopian or speculative fiction, but as people keep sending me emails about various things that they're already witnessing, I begin to realize that it was also a kind of act of journalism.
We're recording this today after a quasi-tornado hit New York City, and I can say there are many trees not growing in Brooklyn right now. I was a little surprised that climate change only plays kind of a walk-on role in the book.
I think, I want to return to climate change, but before I do that, I want to understand it a little bit more. It's obviously happening, but this book has so many moving parts. There's so many things I'm going after, the economic aspect, the technological aspect, immortality, that I think this will require some more thought on my part. But I think also, the tangible effects of it are becoming more and more evident just on an anecdotal basis. And that's where it really kicks in as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I deal with things anecdotally. If scientists tell me it's getting warm, but I don't experience it, then I will say, okay, this is a problem. But for my characters to experience it viscerally, I actually will require more summers like the one that we've just had.
And more storms like we had yesterday.
I was in Boston, so I missed it.
It was truly remarkable. Trees down all over Brooklyn.
No kidding.
Hailstorms, giant hailstorms. it was apocalyptic. The narrator, who seems like a highly nebuchized version of yourself, has a thing for Korean women. What's the significance of that?
I wanted to write a novel, and I've always wanted to write a novel that's an immigrant novel, but that has more than one ethnicity. And the ethnicity I've been sort of left with is, of course, Russian Jews, since I grew up with it. So my first two books had a Russian Jewish, a Soviet Jewish nebbish kind of roaming around the world. And in this book, I wanted to have a native-born American, but of Soviet Jewish heritage. And I wanted to expand my range a little bit and have a Korean woman be his love interest. Lenny and Eunice are the two love interests. But I also thought of Lenny as being and also a different kind of immigrant. He's an immigrant from the past, living in a world that really belongs to people like Eunice, his love interest, who's 24 to his 39, who doesn't really read books. In college, she majored in images and minored in assertiveness, so she has a very different kind of take on the world. And I'm fascinated by Korea. As I've said before, I think it's just a country that really is living in the future in a way that most countries are not. And I went to Stuyvesant High School, so I've always been surrounded by Koreans. And my mentor, Chang-Grae Lee, was Korean, brilliant author.
I saw Stephen Roach, the economist at Morgan Stanley, at the Council on Foreign Relations yesterday. He said he was complaining about what a mess the United States is, the U.S. economy. He said, I've spent so much time complaining about this, nobody listens, so I moved to Asia. Is that a temptation?
I mean, if I were somehow involved with finance, obviously, I think that's where the future will be. There's no question about it. I mean, I find it so interesting that we're so obsessed with the Middle East as a kind of existential issue for us. But frankly, I don't buy it. I mean, who cares whether you support Israel or the Arab states? I don't think it's really the center, should be the center of our attention. Asia's where it's happening. And the more we get mired in all this crap in that part of the world, the less relevance will have at the end, at the end of the day.
I noticed something you call security state Israel appears in the book several times. Well, what's this, how does that fit in? What's the significance of that?
Oh, well, I'm thinking of an Israel in the future that's basically a kind of theological theocracy, you know, that's controlled by, well, it's already very, almost there, you know, Netanyahu's secular, or Likud is a secular, but I think in the end it will be more of a kind of Jewish theocracy.
But they're politically dependent on all the religious parties.
Politically religious, yeah, politically dependent religious party, and of course in the end dependent on America's goodwill and the resources we place behind them. I have, you know, I go to Israel, I have a lot, I have friends there and who are more secular, and I think their dream is for America to just step back a little bit so that we're not as controlled by evangelicals in America and the AIPAC, which I don't think represents a lot of Jews, certainly not Jews like myself.
But are the U.S. and Israel sort of like arm in arm heading towards a doomed future?
In the book, yes, they're two countries that are together and going marching toward the grave. Although, you know, again, I mean, Israel's mentioned in the book, but I almost didn't want to concentrate on Israel because, again, I think the less said, the better, in a way. It's important to concentrate on parts of the world that really will matter in the future. And all my books take a line against religion and nationalism, in a way. I'm more interested in a future where I think countries will matter, of course, but it's really city-states that will matter even more, like New York or Los Angeles, places where the economy really is, where people of all nationalities mix and create a kind of incentive for new things to happen, whether it's cultural or any economic, technological. So I think we place too much emphasis on small nations that are will be mired with religious ethnic conflicts for the rest of their existence, I believe.
But this city-state in the book has turned into, Manhattan, Brownstone, Brooklyn, or all that matter, right?
Yes, it's called Trophy City, New York. That, of course, is the scary part, too, that New York has become, to such an extent, a city of millionaires, an island of millionaires, if you look at Manhattan. And that's very depressing.
I'm gathering you have a rather gloomy view of America's future. Or present.
Present. Part of me also thinks that, I mean, it's important who's in charge, but this is a natural cycle. Empires like ours rise very quickly, and sometimes the decline is also just as fast. This happens to every nation that's ever achieved this kind of supremacy over the world that we've had. You can't think of any empire that's... the dream is, of course, to just mellow out and become a, you know, the Dutch mercantile empire, and that was just a nice place to get stoned and look at some interesting design. I think that's a fine future for us as well, if we can afford it.
In Spain, it had an economic crisis, not so bad either.
Yeah, Spain.
A Spanish friend of mine says the United States now reminds him of 16th century Spain, only they had better writers.
Yes, better writers, but the roads are better now.
So I imagine you think that contemporary America, at least, will provide you with lots of rich material for future work.
If there's enough readers remain, then certainly I think it'll be a... I look forward to writing about this country. It really does make me... it sort of takes away the need to buy an airplane ticket to Russia, and my sense of maximalist and absurdism can now be satisfied by this country.
I've been speaking with Gary Steingart, author of the novel Super Sad True Love Story, just out from Random House, and a very fine book it is. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a great song from the band Material, with Nona Hendrix singing Busting Out, from way back in 1982. Till next week, bye. Thank you.